Perhaps the most pervasive and insidious form of sin is what we experience and encounter in our own pride. If we look at the history of sin, it is impossible for us not to see the relevance of a better understanding of the issue of pride. In fact, we go back into the garden with Adam and Eve, and Satan came and tempted them not with wealth, not with riches, not with power. But he said, if you go against what God has told you to do, you will become like him and you will be God yourself. It's always been the besetting sin of all mankind is pride. The problem is that we don't recognize it in some of its more camouflaged forms. One of those forms is found in the sense of entitlement that oftentimes is expressed through either wrong spirituality or at the very least immature spirituality. So it comes out like this. God, it's not fair. And then you can fill in whatever you like. Well, I don't like that because, I mean, after all, I've served you and I've given money and I've helped people that needed help. And I go to church on a quasi-semi-regular basis. It's just not fair. God, if you're a loving God, how could you send someone to hell? God, if you're a loving God, how could you let suffering continue? God, if you're a loving God, and fill in your own. Well, if this is all I'm getting out of faith, I might as well just not do it at all. These are the kinds of statements that are generally accompanied by what is, in essence, a pride-filled, self-centered, immature mentality. And as a result of it, it eats away and erodes the very foundation of faith that is only going to be realized and known through genuine, lasting dependence on Christ. Philip Ryken tells a story that there was a mother in the field near her home playing with her young child. Her son was just taking the time out of the day to just have some fun. Suddenly, a twister came roaring across the plain, and they were unable to escape. And as a result, it lifted her son up into the air, and he disappeared. She fell to her knees and she cried out to God and said, God, please return my son to me unharmed. And almost before the words were out of her mouth, her son gently fell to the ground in front of her unharmed. She snatched him up and then she pulled him back and inspected him as a mother would. And then she looked up to heaven and she said, God, he had a hat. I'm glad to know you're still with me. It's not a very good joke. Even by my standards, it's not a very good joke. But it is a telling story, is it not? It speaks to us of the sense of entitlement that we oftentimes feel. But I want us to understand, as Jesus addresses this very issue, that he's calling us out of that into a greater dependence of faith in him. But before we can do that, we must address the problem of Christian entitlement. In chapter 17, then, we see this displayed for us in verses 7 through 19 in two different stories, one of which is probably somewhat familiar to you, the other perhaps not so much. In verses 17, in 7 through 10, we see the first of these stories. It says, will any of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once and recline at table? Will he not rather say to him, prepare supper for me, dress properly, serve me while I eat and drink, and then afterward you will eat and drink. Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that you were commanded, say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty. As Christians, we are duty bound. And so this sense of being duty bound is expressed or reflected in the attitude of the master and the servant. In the story of the parable, Jesus, of course, is the master. You and I are the servants. And he says, in a common scenario where the master and the servants are out doing the day's work, when they come in, does the master say to the servants, you know what, you've had a hard day, why don't you take it easy? I'll fix dinner tonight, I'll serve you. Generally, that doesn't happen. He said it doesn't even fit with what the normal custom or understanding was at that time. He said that's not the way it works, but rather the master comes in and he is served by the servants even after they've worked all day, because this is still part of the expected responsibility of that servant. So that when it is done, he doesn't offer gratitude because the servant has simply done what was his duty. We look to God to pat us on the back or to somehow encourage us or to lift us up or to tell us good job or do whatever it is that we sometimes think he should do, when all along we are barely even doing what is the fundamental basic duty. We have this attitude that God exists to serve us, to make our life easier, better, or whatever. And the problem with that is it is the reverse of what the Bible clearly teaches. Jesus himself even said, I did not come to be served, but to be a servant. One of the greatest ways to overcome pride and one of the greatest and most specific ways for us to deny this Christian entitlement that is so pervasive among our culture today is to realize that God has called us to be servants. Servants surrender their lives. Servants sacrifice. Servants put others first. Servants recognize that they are dependent on their master. Who is your master? Or are you your own master? We are duty bound. Duty bound to do that which God has commanded us, and to do so without the expectation of reward. Think about this in relation to modern American Christianity as it is so often expressed, not just in this church or any other particular church, but just in general. American Christianity, without any sort of denominational influence or even theological persuasion, generally speaking, oftentimes is driven much more by our own culture and our own decided expectations than it is by scriptural truth. When that happens, we're always in a dangerous place, but inevitably one of the problems that will arise out of this untheological, unscriptural, ungodly way of living and shaping religion is that it will ultimately be man-centered, never Christ-centered. Always. Even nationalism is confused with patriotism, and then it's confused with faith. Loving America and loving God are not the same thing. I know I'm a communist, right? I'm sorry. Loving God and loving America are not necessarily the same thing. When they become the same thing, then we substitute loving America for loving God. It doesn't work like that. Loving God is eternal. Loving America isn't. Now, am I saying that you shouldn't be patriotic? I am not saying that at all. Please don't quote me as saying that. Am I saying that we shouldn't even be nationalistic? I'm not saying that either. We are citizens of a great nation, and we are richly blessed to be a part of that, and we bear a direct and immediate responsibility for our own governance. It's the very nature of democracy. For us to deny that or to walk away from that or to ignore that is to fail to do our duty as citizens. But to believe that serving a country or serving a nation or serving a particular people or serving in a specific event is the equal to serving God, who is the Lord over all countries, over all circumstances, over all events, is flawed thinking. You will never be a better citizen than when you are more surrendered to Christ. You will never be more patriotic than when you are committed first to Jesus. You will never have a clearer perspective of the greatest potential for the glory of God in the midst of all the circumstances that will inevitably arise, not only in our lifetime, but also throughout the course of history, than when we have a laser-like focus on truth. In fact, I would suggest that it is impossible for us to be a nation with hope if we are a nation without Jesus. It may be radical thinking, or it may just be radical in the sense that you haven't thought about it. But remember, this is not me. I'm just taking it as it comes. This is what Jesus is calling us to. What is it that you're holding on to that you hold out in front of Him or between you and Him? And what is it that you currently have that if you were to lose it, you would no longer want Him? Whatever that is, you have made that more important than Jesus. Whoever that is, you've made them more important than Jesus. Can't do that. You say, well, does that diminish God? It doesn't diminish God, because God is sufficient in and of Himself. It diminishes you. Serving God and being surrendered to Christ and loving God and doing that which we are duty-bound to follow His commandments is the expression of our love for Him. Jesus said, whoever keeps my commandments loves me. We want credit. We want praise. We want to feel good. We want to have stuff. And so we want to do all of that, and then we want to be justified. So we take our avarice, we take our appetites, we take our cultural norms, we take even that which we know to be the opposite of what the Bible teaches, and we bring it into the church. We allow it to grow into something that is bigger than life itself. We bless it, we baptize it, and we say it's okay. And then anybody who challenges it will just get mad at you. And if we get mad at you strongly enough, you'll back down, or at least you'll shut up. But the Bible will not be silenced, and the word of truth will not go away. We can create this false world that is devoid of truth, or we can recognize that this really never has been about us, but always about Him. Jesus, in teaching this very brief message, called them to that attention and denied some of the common things of the day, and it reminds us that pride is universal, and it is also without limitations historically. And then he launched into another experience. It says, on the way to Jerusalem, verse 11, he was passing along between Samaria and Galilee, and as he entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance. They lifted up their voices, saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. in the opposite of what we have just been talking about with the pride-filled attitude that so often is pervasive in our culture, now we see people who are destitute, lepers, cut off from society, forced to live outside the cities and the communities and alone. They've banded together for mutual support and comfort, and there are 10 of them, and they are on the way that Jesus is traveling, and they cry out to him. They don't say anything other than have mercy. There's a cry for mercy. Ultimately, the way you and I come to Jesus is the same way that these guys did. We come to Jesus recognizing that we have nothing to add, nothing to offer, and nothing that can increase that which is already contained within all that he is. We don't come in order to make faith and religion and Christianity better. We come because we realize that there is nothing good in us in and of itself. So that we eventually reach the point where we become aware and we become overwhelmed with our own sin and we cry out to Christ for mercy. That's exactly what he does here. They cry out, they lift up their voices and they say, Jesus, have mercy on us. So not only is there a cry for mercy, but they also receive a response. Look at verse 14. When he saw them, he said to them, go and show yourselves to the priest. And as they went, they were cleansed. We learn from this that help comes through obedience. They cried out to mercy. Jesus said, go, show yourself to the priest. Now, the practice of the day was that the priest served in Judaism like a health inspector. And so if someone had a disease, they were isolated from the community. God had given pretty strict orders to the nation along the way during her days of development. And so this was a protection measure to prevent the spread of this disease within the community. Some of that had been accentuated beyond what God ever told them to do, but nonetheless, this is the way it worked. These men had leprosy, a disease that was highly contagious and deadly. And so they were isolated. Sometimes they couldn't tell the difference between some other type of rash and leprosy. And so a person would be isolated, the rash would go away within a matter of time, and then in order for them to re-enter the culture that they were isolated from, they would have to be inspected by the priest. So they would go and show themselves to the priest. They would look at the affected area. They would determine that it's healed, it's no longer present, no longer a threat, and then they could come back home. That was true of anyone that was a part of this community. So Jesus says to them, go show yourselves to the priest. Now remember that when he says this, these men are still covered with leprous sores. And they are still diseased. But he doesn't say be healed or be cleansed. He just says go show yourselves to the priest. And they turn and they walk away to do what he said. And as they are going, they look down and everything is healed. The miracle comes in the process of obedience. And you will discover that a lot of times you will encounter the blessing of God most strenuously and strongly revealed, not through something that comes in advance of your commitment, but in the process of your obedience. God is revealed through our obedience, not ahead of it. Moses wanted to know over and over, how can I be sure that what you're telling me to do is the right thing to do? How can I be sure that if I go back to Egypt, they won't kill me? How can I be sure that these people will even follow me when I tell them to come and let's go to this land of promise you speak of? How can I know all of this? If you would just show me all of this, I'd be willing to do it. I just need to see the plan. I need to know you got this. God said, when you go to Egypt, you do what I tell you to do, you say what I said to say, and you deliver the people and you lead them out of the land of Egypt, across the Red Sea and back to the mountain of Horeb. And you stand here and you look around, you'll remember, I told you all this stuff, then you'll know. In other words, you get nothing in advance, but the opportunity to obey. Do you know why I want God to tell me his plans? Is it to overcome fear? It's not really. I want God to tell me his plans so I can sign off on them. Make sure he did it right. What does that sound like? Does that sound like the pride that feeds entitlement that we were talking about earlier? I think so. I think it's the same one. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm just not sure that God's going to do it the way I think it ought to be done. I'm not sure God's going to do it the way that I think it could be done, so that it minimizes the cost to me. It also minimizes me from being the spotlight of attention that might also demand a greater level of commitment on my part. It minimizes all those things because now I can orchestrate and I can manipulate the process so that it benefits me directly. That's why I need God to show me his plan, so that I can be God. I'm telling you, it doesn't work like that. I know, because I've tried. And I got to tell you, I still want to do it that way today. I don't think that's ever going to go away from me. I think as long as I have breath, and as long as I live in this broken body, and as long as I'm a part of this broken world, my attitude is going to be broken and constantly need to be reminded that I depend on God, not the other way around. That's why I need worship. That's why I need to read my Bible. That's why I need to pray. That's why God has called me to minister and serve, to remind me, not that he needs me, but of how desperately I need him. Help comes through obedience. They looked down and they were healed. Glory comes, though, through thanksgiving. Verse 15. One of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan. One of the ten returns. Rather than looking just at the fact that he was one, look at him and listen to what he says. He returned praising God. There was something that happened in him that came out of him that was uncontainable. Something that couldn't be squelched or quenched. And it didn't matter whether anybody agreed with him or followed him. In fact, I'm sure he wasn't even fully aware that he was by himself. He was so overwhelmed with what God had done in his life and with what Christ had done to deliver him that he praised God. And when he got back to where Jesus was, he fell at his feet and he thanked him. This is the way we should be grateful to God. Not, hey, thanks, but, you know, he did have a hat. Thanksgiving that is unqualified. Thanksgiving that leaves no room or measure for doubt, but just leaves it all out there on the ground. That's what he did. He was overwhelmed with the grace of God to the point where there was nothing left inside of him except gratitude. You can remember those moments. All of us can. One of the reasons that we go through the process of remembering through the Lord's Supper on a regular basis throughout the year, so that we reflect on what Jesus has done for us on the cross in his death and resurrection, in the shed blood and broken body. That's a time for us to remember that everything that resulted in our forgiveness and everything that has resulted in our righteousness is not our own doing, but his. And that he did it at great cost and pain. And he did it by giving literally everything that there was to give. And so we remember that, and it gives us a greater appreciation for all that we've received in grace. But have you ever paused to consider the grace that we all get? It's called common grace. Common grace is that the sun shines and the rain falls and the air and oxygen around us is breathable and everybody gets to share that. You don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to serve God. You don't have to believe in God in order to breathe air. That's common grace. Everybody gets it. You say, well, what about the Christians? Isn't their air better? Actually, it's not. It's worse. It's all laced with heavy doses of caffeine. And so it's just, you know, the air that we're breathing is all caffeinated and coffeeed up. And so it smells bad. What about Christians? Don't they get more rain? Rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. No distinction. It's common grace. It's common grace that exists in the world by which God reveals himself to that world, so that the Bible would say to us that everything that can be known about him has been made known through the created order in which you and I live. Common grace is not to provide for the needs of humanity. Common grace is to display the glory of the Creator that made it. But we don't even get that sometimes. Special grace is that grace by which Jesus Christ enables within us the hope of the glory of the living God and reminds us that we are desperately in need, not just of his grace to sustain life itself, but desperately in need of his grace that we might be redeemed. And we have nothing to offer or add, but we come as this man came, falling on our faces with thanksgiving. Jesus asked the question then, were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? 90% of the problem is just that. 90% are part of the problem. Only 10% seem to get it in this story. One man out of 10 comes back. And not just any man, but Jesus identifies him and says, this Samaritan, this foreigner. This man wasn't even part of the family of God. He was a half-breed in the minds of most Jews. Samaritans were part Jew and part Gentile, and they had formed their own type of worship of God, and they worshiped in their own place because they had been cut off and rejected by the Jews. Rather than being brought in and being accepted as brothers and sisters, they were pushed aside, and they were considered worse even than outcasts. But those things didn't matter, and distinctions didn't make any difference when you had leprosy. Everybody's kind of level in that kind of decaying sin and disease. Same thing's true with you and me. We sometimes puff ourselves up because we're from this place or that place, or we do this or we do that, or we have this or we have that, or we belong to this church or that church, and we start to build ourselves up in order to try to display our plumage before others as if we are better because of that. The reality is we're all just a group of diseased sinners dying as a result of that disease in desperate need of mercy. But when we get it, what do we do with it? In this case, 90% went their way. No one returned to give thanks except the man who was the most unlikely of sources. How about you? Do you offer thanksgiving to God for the common grace that he gives you every day? Let me challenge you to start praying for your meals before you eat them with something other than, I don't know, bless the meat, curse the skin, open up, poke it in, you know. Let's work on it a little bit, okay? You can do better than that. And now, every time you pray today, you're going to think about that, aren't you? So you're writing it down, you know. Pray before your meals. I'm not talking about at home only, where it's comfortable and easy. Do it when you're at the restaurant. You say, well, some of the places that I go eat, you know, it's just not really appropriate. Then maybe you shouldn't be there eating. Maybe that's the problem. Well, some of the people that I gather with, they'd be uncomfortable with that. Maybe it's time that they got uncomfortable with their sin. Maybe that's what God wants to do. I'm not saying that you have to be obnoxious about it. I have a rule when we have prayer at the meal table in a restaurant, and this rule was formed years ago over an experience with a gentleman that I often went to lunch with, and if you ask him to pray in a restaurant, he'd pray for, 10 minutes. I mean, it was, waiters and waitresses are coming up and interrupting and then feeling, guilty and uncomfortable and awkward. And so out of that, I was telling a fellow about that experience and how uncomfortable it was at this restaurant. And he said, here's the rule. He said, if you pray for a minute, I pray with you. If you pray for 2 minutes, I pray for you. If you pray for 5 minutes, I pray against you. Listen, I'm not telling you that you have to be weird or awkward or uncomfortable or make everybody else feel that way. I'm telling you, you need to be grateful. And one of the most basic, fundamental ways that we can do that is offering thanks before a meal. Not as a routine or a ritual, not as some sort of duty to elicit a blessing from God, but simply as an acknowledgement that everything that is sitting in front of you and everything that has come to you and everything that you're going to experience, good, bad, or otherwise, comes down from the Father of lights. We owe Him everything. Set aside a period and portion of every prayer time that you have in your quiet time, when you're praying with others, when we're worshiping together, to include gratitude and thanksgiving. Be part of that 10% that sets a new course that leads back to the feet of Jesus. Jesus said to him in verse 19, "Rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well." The word "well" is the same word that we get our word salvation from, at least a form of it. And what he is saying to us is that not only has this man been healed physically, but it is quite likely that he has just experienced spiritual healing as well. Physical healing is for a while. Salvation is forever. This is what God has called us to be. This is the best way for us to overcome the problem of Christian entitlement. This is the way we get our eyes off of ourselves and onto the Savior. This is how we move beyond the limitations that have been established by whatever the routines or the rituals are of a culture. This is the way we become the people that He has called us to be in a world that desperately needs someone who is willing to love Jesus, even if 90% of the population doesn't. The problem of Christian entitlement is the age-old problem of pride. And pride always puts dependence and trust and faith on self. And I'm telling you, you and I aren't enough. But I'm telling you, Jesus is more than enough.